All right, we'll call to order the October 7th meeting of the Historic Preservation Committee. The first item on the agenda is adoption of the agenda. Is there a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Great. Public comments? No public comments. All right, old business. We've got two things on old business. One is a presentation by the intern, and then we have a discussion of remote participation in meetings. So,
we skipped approving the minutes.
Oh, well, I guess you're right. Okay, I skipped the minutes. Okay, sorry. We need to approve the minutes. Is there a motion to approve the August 9th, 2019 minutes?
Make a motion to approve the August minutes.
Second.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Now it's more on old business. Again, this is going to be a presentation, kind of a mid-semester presentation by our intern who's been working diligently on getting his kind of good handle around the potential historic district here. Probably the major issue after this is to come up with some direction as to what would be the boundaries that we're thinking about for the historic district. So he can start maybe doing a little more detail, digging into it and get it into some sort of a written form right now. So I'm going to turn it over to Joe. So, Joe.
Okay, so this is just kind of a brief overview of what I've done thus far. So like Dr. Galbraith kind of touched on, at the end of the meeting, I'm going to ask for a little bit more guidance as the research that I've done is pretty surface level. Moving forward, I would like a little bit more, I guess, guidance as to where we want this overlay district to take place. So, so far, I have reviewed General Statute 160A-400, which explains the process for creating an overlay district. One of the key sections of this general statute defines the characteristic of a historic district, and so I put that on the screen for you guys to take a look at. And you can see that I've highlighted or underlined the term culture. Curie Beach, while having a rich history, doesn't exactly have a long history. Most of the buildings within the B1 district were constructed in the mid-20th century. So that stuff about the prehistory and the architecture doesn't really apply to the town. However, if we look at the culture, there's definitely cultural significance to Curie Beach. I think we can find a few specific examples within the town. So I'm thinking, the pier, some of those other local businesses down there that we can, do a lot more research into and explain how they define the culture of Curie Beach. And after talking with Dr. Galbraith for a little bit, I think the focus of this research and the report should kind of touch on the culture more so than the history and the architecture of the B1 district. Going forward, I also reviewed the Curie Beach land use plan, and I wanted to make sure that there was some consistency in making sure that the overlay district was going to be supported by the land use plan. And I do believe that it's going to be supported by the land use plan. You can see in sections 1 and 6 in part 1 and in section 2 in part 2 support the overlay district. So these just include the vision statement of the town, future land use development. And so again, I think that the land use plan is going to support the adoption of an overlay district. I've also reviewed the South Pearson, I'm going to go ahead and assume that's how you pronounce that, and South Bund example that was given to me, and that's just an example that was submitted to the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources. While this example is a little bit larger than Curie Beach, it's a pretty good framework for the Historic Designation Report. And so it's my plan to, when it comes time to write the report, to kind of mirror this example. So you can see on the screen that it's broken up into subsections that include the background for the historic designation, the recommendations, why we want to create this historic overlay, and which specific parts of town are going to be included in the overlay, and then comprehensive plan, so how the land use plan supports the overlay district, as well as historic and cultural significance, again, the things that we're going to talk about, touch on in the report. And then one of the more interesting things in this report is the inventory section. And so that's just a catalog of every single parcel of land that's within the historic overlay. And just kind of gives you a brief history as to what was there and how that was significant to the area.
Should point out real quick that when I talked to Raleigh, that's the report that they gave me that they call the model template for this. Yeah, so that's what they are working from and would expect our report at least to follow somewhat.
Okay. So yeah, again, that's why I'm just going to use it as the model. So continuing with that inventory list that I saw in the South Pearson, South Blount example, I went ahead and kind of did that around town. So I cataloged all of the parcels and all of the buildings within the B1 district. And then I, conducted some research on the New Hanover County Tax website and got an idea of when these buildings were constructed and, what kind of materials they were used. And again, so that example that was given to South Blount, South Pearson is a little bit bigger. They had about 140 examples, but, B1 only has about 40 buildings. So, again, it's a little bit different, but it is going to be a good framework for the designation. And then finally, I conducted some preliminary research in the history of downtown Perry Beach via the New Hanover County website. Again, that was with building ages, materials, who owned the land previously. I made my way down to the Federal Point History Center, and I've got quite a few oral histories that I'm looking through, quite a few newspaper clippings from the Federal Point History Center and the newspapers.com, so that kind of gives me an idea of what kind of events were going on down in Curry Beach. So that's that. All right, this is a visual representation of kind of what we're working with. You can see the image on the left is kind of a close-up of the B1 district, and I put a box around the exact B1 district. The lighter blue represents, or the lighter the blue, the older the building is, and the darker the blue, the newer the building is. So you can see where that pavilion is. That's going to be extremely dark blue, but right across the way is the Curie Diner that was constructed in 1935. So you can see how it's the contrast there.
What obviously most of them, with the exception of the pavilion, are lighter blue.
Yes.
And there's other one. What would be the dates of kind of the range of dates of the ones in the B1 district? Would you say?
So I'll touch on that in a little bit. But residential wise, or the residential units within the B1 district are a good range is the 1930s between the 1970s, and then the buildings like the commercial buildings within the B1 district, late 1940s to early 1970s. So that's kind of what we're looking at. And again, I'll show you that in a later slide. But I also, the image on the right is a map of all of Curry Beach. And you can see the closer that we get to downtown Curry Beach, the lighter blue it is. So just, Curry Beach, the origin of the town, it starts downtown and then it works its way out. So that's just another representation of the historical significance of the downtown area. And then, so this is just a quick slide of some current topics, and I kind of go into a little more detail with some of them. But that's just an image, kind of what we're looking at in the 1950s, what Curry Beach looked like. The parking hasn't changed. It looks really, really similar in aerial perspective. But I think something that we really need to touch on in the report is going to be the fishing up here. So if you look at all of the newspaper articles and just oral histories dating back to the genesis of Curry Beach, everyone's kind of making the same comment that people came down Curry Beach to fish and use that fishing pier. So I think it's really important that we highlight the importance of the fishing pier to the community. So of course the pier that's out there now is not the same one that was constructed in 1923 as a result of hurricanes, they had to rebuild, but it's the same kind of concept that the idea that the fishing pier was there, it's kind of one of the centerpieces in town, and it should be definitely be included in the report. towards. Bud and Joe's, and you might be a little bit curious as to why I chose this, but not necessarily Bud and Joe's the business, but Bud and Joe's the building. So after the Second World War, the folks that were down at Fort Fisher, they abandoned all the barracks. And so what was happening in the late 40s and early 50s is residents, part-time residents and full-time residents living in Curie Beach were actually buying those old barracks and then transporting them up to the town limits and then converting them to summer cottages. And so Bud and Joe's is an example of one of those old barracks. So it's pretty interesting. It's not totally unique, but it is one of the last examples of the military barracks still in Curie Beach. So again, it's kind of interesting and kind of important. And something else that's kind of interesting that I've stumbled upon doing my oral history research is that there's a good possibility that Bud and Joe's is actually the Old Town Hall. So the building right next to Bud and Joe's, the one that's vacant now, was a liquor store. And so there was a reference, and again, I'm not 100% certain on this, but there's a reference to how the Old Town Hall was right next to the old liquor store. So and it wasn't exactly a town hall, it was just kind of like a meeting place for the residents and the elected officials to kind of meet. So, again, once we kind of get an idea of what exactly the overlay district's going to be, I can look into that claim, because that's kind of a larger claim that needs to be, kind of improved. But it was just kind of something to look into. Other kind of topics of interest is, Curie Beach during the Second World War, the impacts of the Second World War in Curie Beach. Of course, Wilmington experienced most of the I don't want to say growth, but most of the, I guess growth from the Second World War. But there was huge housing, lack of housing with the Wilmington Shipbuilding Company up in Wilmington. And so what you saw was a lot of employees coming to Curie Beach and living down here. And so after, and then with the combination of Camp Davis, which was just 20 miles north, and then the Fort Fisher over here, you had a lot of traffic from those people involved in the war. And so after the war, you saw a lot of people coming down to Curie Beach and making Curie Beach their place of residence or their vacation home. Another thing that I thought was pretty interesting is the Fort Fisher Railroad, and there's not a whole lot of documentation on this, but Hans Curie, when he first started developing the area, there was a railroad line from the river where his steamship kind of docked, and then it went directly to what we consider downtown now. So the last stop would have been approximately where that stoplight is now. So it's kind of an interesting little feature of the town. Of course, it's not there anymore, but it's something worth kind of mentioning. And then this is just, some examples of some of the cataloging that I did. So again, it's that same image of the buildings, the lighter the blue it is, the older it is. And so I just kind of, just another visual representation for you. And so then this also brings me to, when I was conducting my research, I just stopped at the Third Point History Center, and I talked with a woman there named Rebecca Taylor, I believe was her name. And she was pretty excited about the idea of an overlay district. And she said that the folks at the Third Point History Preservation Center would be willing to help in any way they could. And then she started talking about this plaque program. So I guess the Third Point History Center has a plaque program that gives buildings, either ages 50, at least, you have to at least be 50, or the building has to at least be 50 years old or 75 years old to get one of these plaques. And so it's something that, if we do go in with this overlay district and gets approved, it's something that, we can look into, and it's another avenue of support from the community. So I think that would be something that should be looked into. And then kind of going back to that building age that you talked about, Dr. Galbraith, so you can see The oldest building in B1 was constructed in 1921, and that's one of the cottages along Fort Fisher Boulevard. And then the most recent residential building that was constructed in 2018. So we have kind of an array of buildings, building ages within the B1 district. And then most of the businesses, again, were constructed in the 40s and 50s, but the oldest one being 1935 and the youngest being 1975, and that would be Jack Macros. So, I should kind of specify that last bullet. That's not within the B1 district, that's within that stretch on K Avenue by the parking lot. So with that, leads me to questions. I think we're going to talk about this, or you guys are going to talk about this, maybe some of the boundaries for the overlay district. That way I can hone in on my research on specific specific parcels, specific buildings, and the importance of those, and then the timeline for the overall project.
All right, great. All right, thanks. Just real quick, again, one purpose of the overlay district here, there are certainly a lot of development pressures in beach communities. I mean, there's no question about it. So when you look at Bud and Joe's, is that an economically viable building in the future? I'm guessing not. Somebody is going to want to probably ultimately buy that and knock it down and build something there. So I think the idea is not necessarily to preserve like a historic district in downtown Wilmington where you actually have 1840 buildings and 1812 houses and stuff like that, but to maintain the feel and the culture and the ambiance. So somebody could come in and maybe knock down Buzz, but what we'd want to go up there is something that at least kind of feels the same as, the 1940s or 1950s type of thing in terms of material, et cetera. And probably a good model of that, actually, I in the distant past, I was a gold miner. And I mined gold up in the mountains of California for 2 years. And that's before it's along Highway 49, which is in California. But that was going back to all the gold mining towns built in 1850, 1860, 1870, and so forth, which when I was up there were all ghost towns. I mean, they were literally ghost towns. It's been discovered. Now, the wine, the yuppies are moving out there, and they're putting wine vineyards and things like that. But what they've done, which is really good, is I'm sure their historic district, version of historic district, so someone comes in and knocks down a building that really needs to be knocked down. Mm-hmm. What goes up is something that still has the feel of that gold mining era and stuff like that. But it's, a little more modern materials. It's obviously, constructed properly and things like that. And I think that's kind of what we're looking at to try to do here is to have things that are put in there that are at least consistent with the culture and the ambiance and the feel of it rather than trying to preserve Bud and Joe's.
Okay.
I mean, I think Bud and Joe's would be great to preserve, but it's
nice.
Probably not an economically
viable.
It's an
old barracks. We might be able to save it.
That's true, yeah. Might be able to move it, actually. Yeah.
Can I make a couple points?
Sure.
First of all, great work. I really enjoyed
yes.
that.
Yes, I agree.
I don't know the district as well as I should. Can you go to slide 12, please? That's the one again. Hang on to that for a minute. First of all, I want to make sure we're consistent with our terminology. We are not NOT talking about an overlay district. We're talking about a historic district, and they're two completely different animals. So we need to be consistent with historic district terminology. Third point, I can't remember your first slide. I know you stressed cultural. But keep in mind that the reason we're going down this path, or possibly the reason the council may go down this path and designate a historical district is so that we can control exterior appearance.
Okay.
Therefore, architecture does play a role.
Okay.
And when you look at these slides, nothing sexy about that architecture, but that's definitely small town family beach. I mean, I grew up in Virginia Beach before it mushroomed, and that's what it was like. So I do think architecture is a relevant consideration, and if you're trying to preserve a small town family beach community, those are good examples of that.
Okay, great, thank you. I think we should address this first question, which is, what's the area to work with?
That's. what we'd like to come out with.
I would just recommend as a starting point, we do the B1 and the multi-use overlay going up K and make that the historic area that we're talking about.
Could you pull up that, the
big one?
The big, so we can look at, because we already have an overlay district going up K.
The two maps.
Yeah, the two maps.
Well, that's more of a topic in the following meeting. I mean, the historical preservation committee is really B1, and the overlays and around it are more planning.
We talked initially about making it going up the multi-use size of K. So we just, you know, it was almost going to be a T, an inverted T.
And you also have B2 in there as well.
So. Yeah, and I know Ken was, I think, was interested in moving it up for Fisher too, looking.
I think that was more our lady friend who was pushing.
Okay.
She was going out further either way.
Yeah. So, but then I still remember that going back to the town council, they pretty much specified. Now we could always go back to them and say, you know, based upon our research, they pretty much limited it to the B1. I mean, that's really what they were. I think when you look at the verbiage during the motion made by the town council and the formation allowing us to form this process is that it was B1. It's pretty much what they were looking at. So I think we might raise, at least right now, some red flags if we go beyond the B1. You know, I think the question is, do we want to just limit it to that, just the downtown area, or because the B1 actually is a little bit larger, because you look at this, we're capturing other things beyond the B1.
So going south, you know, past the stoplight, all of those, with the exception of maybe two buildings, are all motels.
Right.
So that's definitely something to consider. And then north of that stoplight, it's essentially all cottages. So with the exception of that one giant motel, I mean, sand dunes.
There was originally concerns about the hotels being knocked down and converted into other type of things. And so my general feeling is, let's just look at the B1. You know, let's grab the B1, do the whole B1 in terms of this proposal to start pushing this thing forward. If you know, we do an update to the council, or if Mr. Whitley's here, who's not here tonight, I thought he might be. That might suggest kind of going beyond it and looking at the T to say going down K Avenue or going up Fort Fisher or something like that, then I think we can add to it. But I think the starting point, at least my recommendation, would be let's look at the whole B1. Based upon what you've done here, I was originally just thinking let's limit us right to the Bud and Joe's and the pier and things like that. But I think looking at this map, I think we should be looking at least at the whole B1.
My concern is as you start going up K, you get into places where people can have a business and a home at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, that becomes an issue for us. I think we need to go back to council and get permission to consider adding K, the special use thing from K.
Yeah. I thought we were going to do that with overlays. That the HPC was for the character, which was in the B1, and then we were going to look at overlays.
We're making the historic overlay from this.
We're not doing an overlay. We
historic overlay.
We jettison the overlay approach in favor of a historic district approach.
For the B1, yes, but I thought we were doing some overlay updates around the B1.
Yeah, I think you're right. When we were talking about K, we were talking about looking at K within the context of stronger special use permits, you know, to maintain some of these characteristics. So looking at, strengthening the special use permit process going up K for the overlay district, and then the historic district would be in the B1 area.
Right.
I mean, that's, I'm trying to think about what we were talking about. So any comments from heaven?
Ken, that would be you.
My one comment is, we're going to do call-ins. I'm only hearing every other word.
Okay. Well, I'm sure you're hearing the good words, though.
So, oh, yeah, I'm only hearing the good ones, yeah. Actually, I can hear counsel very well.
Thank you.
So, recommendation.
I recommend that the HPC focus strictly on the B1 district.
That would be my recommendation, too.
I'll support that.
Okay, all right. So that would be the guidance there to push ahead, but just looking at the B1, but the full boundary of the B1 rather than a smaller segment.
It was a second question.
Second question is timeline.
Yeah.
You're about halfway through the semester now, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
But I will say that the internship with the program at UNCW, it's not time restrictive. It's just it's time restrictive in the sense that how many hours are you putting into it, but it's not.
Calendar restricted.
Yeah, it's not calendar restricted.
Okay.
So, if it's something that you guys will entertain and it's something that you guys would like to extend beyond the semester, that's completely fine with me.
Well, what's your recommendation?
I mean, knowing the speed and your time.
So, for one person to do the research and to, start compiling a report, it's a large project. So I think, maybe having a rough draft of the project by December, I think is obtainable, but maybe a final draft, going beyond that. So I think an extension of the internship is required. I think that would be beneficial for both myself and the final product.
So the good news is you want to do both the rough and the final.
Well,
that would have to be worked out with his intern person to
whatever
extra.
Whatever you guys want is kind of.
Obviously we're going to have to present this to town council. We're going to have to, have public hearings on it and things like that. I was thinking about the sequence, and I think that we need to have a rough draft of what we're talking about before we go into public hearings. So from my experience, public hearings, just to kind of chit-chat, it will dissolve into, all sorts of problems. But if we have something we can talk about in a public hearing and the town council can, have some meat to it. So, I think that's a good timeline. If we could have a rough draft of what you think this report would look like, and again, you and I are working on a weekly basis, mm-hmm. By December, I think that would be great, and then that would give us some time to think about it, maybe come back in January, start public hearings, get the feedback from town council, whether you're involved, if it kind of works out extending that, or, we have another intern, or we have to do it ourselves, we'll take that when it comes. But if we could have a rough draft, I think that would work.
December meeting, yeah.
Yeah, for the December meeting.
One question, did you finish the inventory or is that a work in progress?
So it's all but, it's pretty close to being done. I'm going to go back and redo most of the pictures now that I know that we are going to focus on the B1 in its entirety. A lot of those pictures that I took were in the middle of the day and there's cars everywhere. So maybe when it's a little bit.
I think that inventory is very critical, so I was curious how far you've gotten along on when you're talking time now.
So the framework for every building, every parcel is listed, but in terms of all the information, it's just missing, maybe 10% of the information. But again, the pictures I would want to update.
Okay.
But as far as a survey of each parcel, so maybe a summary of what exactly happened there or where we're kind of going with that has yet to be done. So that's, if you're going to include that into the inventory, then we still have quite a bit of ways to go.
I think you also pointed out that looking at that Pierce, or the
Pearson.
The Pearson one is that. There was a parking lot in it, but it was originally like a slave.
Yeah, it was at one. So the thing with the South Pearson, South Blount district is it was very important to the African American community, and so at one point in this parking lot that you're referring to, there was a church that was important for the community, but now as time went on, it was torn down and now it's just a parking lot. But they included the fact that parking lot used to be a church and how important that church was to the community. So
So you were thinking about the railroad, you know, the stoplight being the ending point of the railroad is kind of that. The railroad's not there anymore, but that's the location where really Curie Beach got started, because that's where the railroad ended.
Yeah,
right there.
I mean,
so
that
okay.
would be, yeah. So okay. it kind of depends on, again, you know, finding the balance between the culture and history. So if we're really going to try to hound in on the cultural aspect, I'm not sure how. Like, if we're going to try to paint a picture of a small town, you know, a small town beach community from the 1950s, it's kind of hard to incorporate history, you know, prior to that. So it was just going to take some tweaking. So if you understand what I'm saying.
If it helps you, I'll contact some people at Fort Fisher, see what I can find out for you there.
Okay. I work at Fort Fisher, so I'm in the know.
Okay. Problem solved.
Great. All right.
I appreciate the research so far. Thank you.
Great job.
Yeah, thank you. Any other comments? John, do you have any comments at all? Or? Nope. All right, excellent. All right, great. Well, thank you very much. Good.
Thank you.
Remote participation in meetings.
I don't have not the PowerPoint like the internet yet. But you do have in your packets a memorandum and a recommended policy. Let me say one thing about the policy first. I set it up as a code amendment, but I understand from Ms. Avery and Ms. Chase it's a rather standard procedure for council to adopt a policy. So if we want to go forward, I'm going to change it to a generic policy, not a code amendment. But anyway, the memo sets forth the discussion we had probably two meetings ago that it's an open issue under North Carolina law whether you can participate remotely, in the sense that our courts have not addressed it, but at the same time there are court decisions that seem to permit it, and there are certain provisions in the open meetings law that favor it as well. But you need to put it in context. And I'll allude also to PZC. An advisory board like PZC, I think remote participation poses little risk. On the other hand, HPC will eventually be in the business of making quasi-judicial decisions, and that is a consideration. So in sifting through everything, you'll see on page 2 the recommendations A, B, C, and D of the memo that is. Allow remote participation only when enough members are physically present to constitute a quorum. In other words, don't rely on heaven, so to speak, to establish your quorum. Do not allow remote participation in closed sessions due to the difficulty of ensuring that no one else is present at the remote location. Permit voting only when a remote member is participating by telephone or video. Permit voting on all matters coming before either commission, except quasi-judicial matters coming before the HPC. Now, when we rescheduled because of the hurricane, I had a window of time, so I went ahead and drafted a proposed policy. You've got that in your packet as well, and that's the header of remote participation policy. Yep. You know, the preamble is what we've already discussed, but I want to turn your attention to two minimum requirements for remote participation. Members shall be permitted to participate remotely only when physical attendance would be unreasonably difficult. We want to encourage physical attendance. Members participating remotely and all persons present shall be clearly audible to each other. That's interesting given Mr. Richardson's comments that he only heard half of the discussion, so that's a consideration. A quorum of the commission, including the person chairing the meeting, shall be physically present. That mitigates against one of the risk factors. I mentioned before and put it into the policy, no remote participation in closed sessions. Again, E was mentioned just a minute ago. You can vote on all matters except quasi-judicial before the HCC. And in order to be transparent and to make sure we're doing everything by the book, all votes taken during any meeting in which a commission member participates remotely shall be by roll call vote. The next section, technology, is self-explanatory, video, audio, whatever technology allows you to do that. I do want to draw your attention to on page 2 of the policy, up at the top, subsection 3 and subsection 5. 2, 3, and 5. 2 and 3 is simply video and audio. You've got to make sure everybody can hear each other and see each other. 5 is an interesting one. It's for the chair. The chair may decide how to handle any technical difficulties. So they've got discretion to kind of shoot from the hip when something comes up, again, like Mr. Richardson's comment tonight. In the event a remote participant is disconnected from the meeting, or I think you could read that broadly, if it's simply not working, the remote participation is not working out, then that would recommend disconnecting, or if the disconnection occurs from a technical standpoint, you simply note that fact at the time in advance. Procedures for remote participation, A, as much upfront notice as you can get. B, at the start of the meeting, the person chairing the meeting shall announce the name of the remotely participating member. That information shall be recorded in the minutes. And when feasible, Ms. Chase would distribute to remote participants in advance of the meeting agenda packet item. And finally, 290, the last one there, adoption and revocation of policy. By statute, this is a matter for council to adopt and revoke if it sees fit after adoption. So your position tonight is, like for any text amendment, come up with a decision on whether this works, review it, and report on it to town council. That's what I'm trying to say. Any questions?
I would, if possible, just for, because technically our planning and zoning is supposed to start at 7 o'clock. This is the same proposal for P&Z, isn't it? What I would just recommend to the HPC here is that we wrap up our agenda here and continue this conversation in the P&Z discussion.
That's fine, except that you'll be wearing two hats when you do that at the same time.
You can do it twice.
I think we can do this pretty simply. I think we can simply
do it by the book.
Okay, all right.
I think we can simply recommend this.
Yeah, I would have one issue here, and that is we do have an attendance policy for P&Z. I'm not sure if we do have an attendance policy for the HPC.
Eventually, we'll have everything that you need for HPC.
Okay. I think somewhere in here we have to define a remote. Does that satisfy being present? One of the things we have to be careful about is that we don't want to have somebody attending all the meetings for P&Z or HP remotely and satisfying the attendance, because you said that we're trying to encourage people to be here. So I think we need to have some sort of a rule or policy as to maybe allowed one time per year or something like that. Or
I don't know that you want, I agree, you ought to put that control in there, but I don't know that it goes here. Got a policy somewhere else about attending the meetings, maybe you could insert a phrase in there. For example, if you miss 3 meetings, you're out. However, each member will be allowed to participate remotely according to the policy once or twice in a calendar year.
Okay, so you recommend that being in that policy rather than in this policy?
Yes,
okay. All right, so I agree with you. We can just go ahead and recommend approval here.
I want to make your motion. Avery, do you have any comments on this?
Just questions. So you're saying, Attorney Eldridge, that this board cannot adopt this policy for themselves. You're saying the council has to adopt this policy for this board?
The in the memo,
that presentation.
I know it should be noted that adopting a remote participation policy is a matter for a governing board to act on and not an automatic right of the remote member to exercise under NC Gen Stat 168-71C. A municipality's governing board has broad authority to adopt local rules not inconsistent with charter, general law, or parliamentary procedure. So if the municipality governing board has broad authority under that statute to adopt local rules, that's that's how I reached the conclusion it was a matter for council. But you always catch me on different things. You may have a different viewpoint. That's my reading of that statute.
So what do you need from us? Just a motion?
A motion that you can pass, a resolution where you
send this policy up for approval to the...
pass that on to council.
Okay, but you're going to rewrite it into a policy rather than a... Okay, so if somebody want to make a motion for that?
I might not get the wording exactly right, but I'll make a motion to submit the rewritten policy to council for approval to allow remote attendance.
Okay. I'm second.
One comment about sure. The remote attendee.
Go for it,
yes.
If we're going to do this, I've been listening for 40 minutes. I can only, if anybody's on the podium or away from the podium, I cannot hear them. If we're going to do this, we need to upgrade some equipment so that you can hear clearly what's going on throughout.
Party members can speak into the mic.
I think, Ken, the bigger issue is that we weren't really near the mics, assuming we didn't need to be.
Yeah, and so when...
that's okay. When council was out there, you can't hear. And when I couldn't hear the gentleman giving the presentation at all.
Oh, okay. So that would be
so
on the podium.
It's not so much the people at the podium. It's the people that are out in the audience you can hear.
That's true. Right.
Okay.
Okay, excellent. Let's finish this because we have a motion. It's been seconded. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Okay. I can't try to, as being a professor at a university where we do a lot of remote teaching and things like that, I would strongly recommend that we get a video conferencing capability in this room here. That would make life...
At least a much better speaker capability.
Yeah. It would be a lot easier as we start to think about this newer type of technology. We do have as new business, one thing is that as we start to get into this for the HPC, we may start to get more into kind of the nitty-gritty of assisting Joe to write this document and having discussions. So maybe one of the recommendations is to change our starting time from 6:30 to 6 o'clock for future meetings.
I support that.
Okay, is that...
At least for the near future.
All right, so... I'll go ahead and make the motion that our future HPC meetings start at 6 o'clock instead of 6:30. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay.
Aye.
Okay. Any member items?
No.
Nope. No. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Okay. Second?
Second.
Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Excellent. Why don't we take about a 2-minute break and then we'll...